It's Monday, November 14th, and this is For Good Reason.
Welcome to For Good Reason. I'm DJ Grothy. For Good Reason is the radio show and the podcast produced in association with the James Randi Educational Foundation, an international nonprofit whose mission is to advance critical thinking about the paranormal, about pseudoscience, and about the supernatural. We've been on hiatus. The show has been on a break due partly to the fact that our producer has been going through law school and has just finished up. And we're happy to say that we're starting up again. Before we get to this week's interview featuring Richard Dawkins, I'd like to invite our listeners to join the JREF, as we call it, the James Randi Educational Foundation, the JREF. I'm happy to say that over the past couple years, we've really worked hard, the team we've assembled, to increase our programs, new educational and outreach programs. You can find out info about these programs at randi.org and sign up for our newsletter for regular updates. Our amazing meeting this last summer in Las Vegas was the largest, the most celebrated amazing meeting so far, but we can't do all of our work combating the purveyors of undue credulity without your help. So won't you please become a member today? You can do so at randi.org. Now about this week's interview. It features a discussion I had with Richard Dawkins at the Amazing Meeting 8 in Las Vegas, July of 2010. We talk about his new book, The Magic of Reality, and about the differences between skepticism and atheism, which one might be more important or more fundamental, and a number of other topics. We even get into comic books somehow. So enjoy the interview, and thanks for listening. Please join me in welcoming Richard Dawkins.
Yeah.
We've had a few of these conversations in the past. I'll try to keep this not very repetitive. So to start off, what's more important to you, to be a skeptic or to be an atheist?
I think it's rather hard to be a skeptic and not to investigate those aspects of theism which make a difference to the real world. So if you're brand of theism is that you think that there's a God that does absolutely nothing, so he might as well not exist, then in a sense that might be said to be untestable, although I think I might dispute even that. But insofar as your God does anything, like wreaks miracles, does anything that you could observe in the real world, turns water into wine, rises from the dead, speaks from burning bushes, heals people when they go to Lourdes, if insofar as he does any of those things, then that should be fair game for a skeptical group such as this one. So insofar as religion affects the real world, then it seems to me that any skeptic worth her salt has got to be at least skeptical of religious claims. It might be argued that there was a kind of residual kind of theism or deism which was immune from skeptical inquiry because it's in some sense untestable. I think I would dispute even that, but maybe I don't know whether DJ you want me to go into that.
I think we'll get to that. I just want to pin you down on this. If you're going to consistently apply skepticism, you think it's a necessary result that you'll be an atheist.
No, I didn't quite say that. Okay. I said that that you should apply your methods of skeptical inquiry to theism. You shouldn't say, we're going to investigate UFOs and astrology and homeopathy, but religion is off limits. The only reason I can think of for doing that would be fundraising. Mm.
So for you, yes, be skeptical of ghosts, also of the Holy Ghost, Even if
nicely
they're...
put, I think you must have used that before.
Yeah. No, this was the first time. Trust me. Yeah. So if there are people in the audience, and I know many of them, I've talked with many friends who aren't atheists. They are deists or mainline Protestants, liberal Christians, something like that. And in the history of the skeptical movement, you have figures like Martin Gardner, who was what we'd consider a fideist. He rather championed the position that said, hey, you atheists, you have all the good arguments, yet I still choose to believe because it comforts me. And do you think that's just one area of his life, like Paul Kurtz said last night in the panel discussion? Well, you don't have to be skeptical about everything.
Yes, I mean, I think Martin Gardner probably was unique. I had the privilege of meeting him toward the end of his life and talked to him about that and heard the argument and was sort of intrigued. But there can't have been many people like him. If you are, as I say, what was the question again? Sorry.
Consistent skepticism implying atheism. Or fideist. I mentioned Martin Gardner's
well,
fideist.
Well, fideist. But as I say, I think Martin Gardner was probably unique. Now, you were saying that there are lots of people in this audience who are skeptics and also deists or theists. Well, I would be curious to know whether they believe that we shouldn't even investigate claims like turning water into wine, claims like people getting healed because of prayer. Mm-hmm. If, say, an investigation of prayer were to be suggested in one of the journals of skepticism which we subscribe to, would that be rejected because religion is off limits?
Well, I think the justificatory scheme in the history of skepticism has been we can zero in on religious claims if they're scientific claims or if they're testable,
well,
but not
course,
just
yeah.
God belief,
no,
right?
Okay. I mean, of course they're scientific claims. If you're claiming that religion can... That prayer can heal, that is a scientific claim. If you're
but
claiming,
for you, God's existence itself is a kind of
well, I would
testable
go further
claim.
And at least raise the question of whether God's existence itself is, if not testable, at least a scientific claim. I've said many times before that a universe that has an intelligent creator at its base would be a very different kind of universe, even if you couldn't test it, even if there was nothing that you could actually look at in the form of an observational or experimental test. But I want to elaborate on that a little bit, because the claim that something is untestable, it seems to me, doesn't mean that it's not amenable to interesting, informative, scientific discussion. Mm. Now, let me give an illustration of something else which is in principle, I think, untestable, but which nevertheless is scientifically worth discussing. My understanding from physicists is that there is a horizon, which is a gigantic sphere, beyond which we cannot ever know what goes on, because beyond that sphere, things are receding from us at greater than the speed of light, and therefore we can never, ever know what is outside that horizon.
You mean in cosmology?
In cosmology. That's right. So there is a sphere of the knowable, the sphere of the in principle testable, outside which we have in principle non-testability. I don't think that it follows from that that nothing that we can say, we shouldn't even speculate about what goes on outside that sphere. So, for example, suppose we were having an argument about the likelihood of there being life or intelligent life or something like that, and we would want to plug in some values into the Drake equation, and so we would want to have some kind of a calculation about how many planets there are. Now, we can count the number of planets in the sphere of the observer. We can't count them, but we could talk about the possibility of counting the number of planets in the sphere of the observable. Outside the sphere of the observable, they are in principle uncountable, and yet the conclusion we come to as the likelihood of there being life elsewhere in the universe would be different if we plug into the Drake equation a speculative number for planets that lie outside the sphere of the testable. Therefore, it seems to me that this thought experiment at least demonstrates that that area of the universe, that area of discourse, which is in one sense, in principle, unverifiable, untestable, unobservable, nevertheless, it is not totally unamenable to scientific discussion.
So for you, the skeptic says, no questions are off limits, no issues are taboo, including religion. Religion doesn't get a special hands-off policy. That's what you're saying.
That's exactly okay. What I'm saying, yes.
Okay. I want to switch gears a bit and look at it from the other direction. There are atheists. So you're kind of making skepticism continuous with atheism, or that it could vary.
Skepticism of gods.
Right, skepticism.
It should be all of a piece with skepticism
of ghosts and
homeopathy and things, yes.
So I know of atheists or humanists whom I would not in any sense consider skeptics, except in this one area, the God claims. So I've been to humanist conferences. God bless humanists. I love them. I am a humanist, a secular one. But humanists talking about chakras or skepticism about UFOs is something not rampant at some humanist conferences. Or let me give a couple examples, like Bill Maher, an atheist that you celebrate, or atheist comedians I love like Joe Rogan. These guys are rousing critics of religion, but I wouldn't really consider them skeptics at all, like I would consider this throng of 1,300 skeptics. So to finish the point, Maher got the Richard Dawkins Award, right? But he's really soft on alternative medicine, kind of a skeptic of vaccines. Joe Rogan is a brilliant social critic and says really smart things about religion, critical of religion, yet he doubts that we actually landed on the moon. He's a moon landing denier, right? So I think it's better to be a skeptic than just an atheist, just a skeptic of the God claim.
Well, I think this comes back to the quote from Paul Kurtz that you mentioned just now, where he said, you can be skeptical about some things but not about others. Now, that's empirically clear. I mean, that obviously there are, evidently there are some people who seem to manage to be, in a sort of bizarre way, atheists and very, very eloquent and powerful advocates of atheism, but yet have completely non-skeptical and I would say dopey view of some other things, such as medicine.
Did you have second thoughts about Bill Maher being the recipient of your award?
Well, the Richard Dawkins Award is awarded by, chosen by the committee of AAI. I'm delighted to have my name associated with it.
But Atheist Alliance International.
Yes, yeah. Atheist Alliance International. I'm delighted to have my name associated with that award. But it's not my choice. I mean,
If it were your choice, would you have made it that direction?
Yes, I think I would. I think I would, because I find Bill Maher such an eloquent spokesman for atheism, which is, after all, the mission of Atheist Alliance International. That I would. But I just note that it is a fact about humans that there are humans who can hold in their heads what seem to me to be, if not incompatible, at least curiously compatible beliefs. And we do know of other examples of people who are, you know, published astronomers who actually write papers on using mathematical techniques and talking about the age of the cosmos, the age of the universe, as being more than 13 billion years old, and they write their scientific papers. But yet, if you ask them what they really believe, they say the world is only 6,000 years, the universe is only 6,000 years old. It does seem to be a fact about human psychology that there are people who can divide their minds in that way, and I have very little intuitive understanding of that.
We know you as an equal opportunity skeptic, and you've just vouched for that. You're not just zeroing in only on God belief. But most people know you as the big atheist, and that's what you've written about, and that's many of your public interviews are on your skepticism of just this one claim. Yes, you've done a great documentary series on alternative medicine and the New Age. I think it was Enemies of Reason, but to you, is there a hierarchy of what James Randi would call woo-woo beliefs? Are there some that merit our critical attention much more than others, or should we spend as much time on cryptozoology as we do, say, homeopathy, alt-med, or God?
I think you could make a hierarchy of importance. I mean, God, the existence of a supreme intelligence that started everything off. I mean, that's the big one, really, isn't it? It I mean, compared with something like Bigfoot, I mean, if somebody discovered in the Himalayas a primate who was maybe a hominid, I mean, it would be totally fascinating. It would in no way shake my worldview. It wouldn't violate any of the laws of physics. It wouldn't change our philosophy of the world. It's an interesting question. It's one of those things where all we can say is, well, there's no evidence, no good evidence for it yet. And it's a perfectly respectable thing to do, to go and investigate it. But it's not a big deal. It's not like God, where it would totally and utterly change my worldview.
Or ghosts, or psychics.
Well,
or...
I think there are intermediates. I think that something like telepathic communication.
Well, that would imply the soul, which could imply God.
Not necessarily, no. I mean, there could be some kind of not radio waves, because we could have detected them, but some form of radiation hitherto unknown to physics. It's highly unlikely. But again, it would be, I mean, that's fairly close to the improbable end of the scale. Something like dowsing, water divining. Once again, all the double-blind tests that have ever been done have failed to show any evidence for it, so therefore I don't believe in it. But if it was shown to be true, my immediate impulse would be, oh, great, interesting, let's now go to work to try to find out this unknown force of physics that we hadn't thought of before.
So it would turn into science. The pseudoscience would turn into science if it were discovered.
That's
but it
right.
wouldn't kind of change your... It wouldn't unsettle you as the big materialist.
That's right. And I think you can make a nice little spectrum. Graphology. I'm aware that graphology, whenever it's been investigated, the idea that you can read someone's character from their handwriting... I find that extremely plausible, and yet I know that all the evidence suggests that there's nothing in it. So once again, that's way, way out on the plausible end of the spectrum. Yeah. Homeopathy is way out on the implausible end of the spectrum, not because no evidence has ever supported it, I mean, that's true, but because if it were found to be true, we would need to completely revolutionize our view of physics. And so... an experimental demonstration, a really good double-blind trial which showed that homeopathy worked, would earn, if it were really definitely proved, it would earn the Nobel Prize in physics as well as the Nobel Prize in medicine. So anybody who wants to believe that should be beavering away trying to do a decent experiment. Of course, they're not. They're beavering away making money out of gullible people.
So you mentioned making money out of gullible people, and if I heard you right, you seemed to suggest that graphology appears to you to be more plausible than these other things. So one thing that gets the ire up of many skeptics who look into graphology is that they see that, much like homeopathists, graphologists appear to be nothing more than hucksters who are peddling nonsense and bilking people out of their moolah.
But the actual claim that's made by graphologists seems to me to be perfectly plausible. The claim that's made by homeopaths is vanishingly implausible. Beyond implausible.
Yeah. I think the word I was going for is homeopathetics, but there we go. So let's get your take on some of these other paranormal claims. People often ask, really only ask you about the God stuff. So about UFOs, let's say aliens, you're not, from what I've read, our conversations before, you're not necessarily a skeptic of alien life elsewhere in the cosmos.
Yes, I think if you think statistically about the number of stars in the galaxy, the number of galaxies in the universe, the evidence, the mounting evidence that probably the majority of at least a certain class of stars have planets, I think a very, very good statistical case can be made that there probably is life elsewhere in the universe, and maybe one could even go further and say intelligent life in the universe. I think that there are very interesting arguments to be had about this. One of them would be this. If you meet somebody who says that they believe that there is no other life, that there are no alien life forms, that means that they are saying that they think that this planet, in all the billions of planets, is the only one where the phenomenon of the chemical phenomenon of the origin of life has happened. Do you see what you're committing yourself to if you say that? What you're committing yourself to is the view that the origin of life is so stupefyingly improbable that we are totally and utterly wasting our time trying to come up with a plausible theory for the origin of life on this planet. Anthropically, we can say that if there is only one form of life, one origin of life, one instance of life in the entire universe, then it has to be on this planet, because here we are. That's the anthropic principle. That's kind of trivial. But what's not trivial is the conclusion that the chemical event, the origin of the first self-replicating molecule, as I would see it, the chemical event which gave rise to the origin of life was such an improbable event that it only happened in one out of a billion, whatever many it is, planets. And therefore, any chemist who bothers to speculate about how the origin of life happened on this planet, who bothers to do experiments with test tubes, who bothers to set up theoretical models, is wasting her time. I, of course, don't believe that for a moment. That's why I'm saying, that's in a way the flip side of what I'm saying, that I believe there probably is lots of life elsewhere in the universe, because I deduce that a consequence of believing the opposite is the almost absurd conclusion that the theory we're looking for, the chemical theory we're looking for of the origin of life on this planet, has to be a very, very, very implausible theory. We should be positively worried if we had a plausible theory, if we are committed to the view that there's only one life form in the universe. So I think that's one interesting argument you can tease out of it. But I think we do need to make a distinction between speculating about the possibility of there being life somewhere in the universe,
and that they're visiting us,
and that they're
here.
Visiting us either as physical bodies in the form of UFOs or something like that, or even in the form of radio waves. It's, of course, far more probable that they'd visit us in the form of radio waves, because radio waves propagate, or at least can propagate, in an ever-expanding sphere, and apart from the problem of attenuation, which is a very serious problem, we no longer can say that it's so vanishingly unlikely that we would be bathed in the radio waves that are radiating outwards from some life form. Of course, it does attenuate. One could imagine a civilization reducing or removing the attenuation somewhat by beaming the signal. If you beam the signal, then the signal will travel very, very much further. But by the same token, the probability that it will happen to hit us is also very much lower. Now, the chance that we would be visited by a physical body is exceedingly low, because when you think of the enormous vistas of space and the huge numbers of possible places that any particular UFO might visit, needles in haystacks just don't begin to compete.
So no one should misunderstand you at a big skeptics gathering like this as someone who believes in aliens visiting us. You just think it's a numbers game. It's very likely there's life elsewhere in the universe. We were chatting before. You really see everything in terms of evolution. Just on the last point, I'll unpack that. So if you think that there are, if you think there's life elsewhere in the universe, it's conceivable that it started well before we did and had a lot more time to evolve.
Yeah.
So does it follow, therefore, that maybe that alien life would in fact appear godlike to us.
I mean, I think that's a very good suggestion. Life has been going on this planet for between 3 and 4 billion years. The universe has been going for between 13 and 14 billion years. So if you just took that simple calculation, there's been room for at least two cycles of complete development of life of our kind before ours even got started. Well, at least one before ours even got started. So you wouldn't need that much time for it to be plausible that somewhere else in the universe there are life forms that are so far advanced that if we ever did encounter them, we would find them indistinguishable from gods, probably more wonderful than any god that any theologian in their puny imaginations could possibly come up with. So, but I think it's very important to add that they would not be gods because they would have come about by at least, if not evolution, at least some kind of plausible incremental process that moves from primeval simplicity to complexity. If you're going to get a form of life intelligent enough for us to either compete on equal terms or else as so superior to us that we would regard them as gods. And by the way, if they ever did visit us with their physical bodies, they would of course have to be vastly superior to us in order to have got here at all. So we would be tempted to bow down and worship them until we reflect on the fact that they themselves came about by a rational process, an incremental process, probably some form of evolution. I would go further and even say probably a form of evolution by a kind of natural selection. They were not all-powerful, all-intelligent, creative beings at the beginning of the universe. That is what really offends the evolutionary worldview. The evolutionary worldview is one that explains how you can get complex intelligence, improbability, by plausible steps. You cannot suddenly magic complexity into existence. You cannot say it just happened. You cannot say it's always been there. That, for me, is the real sticking point. That's why magic of the... I'm not talking about conjuring. That's why I make the distinction between conjuring and magic. Magic of the form, magic of the type where witches turn frogs into princes. That's not just that has never happened. It never could happen because that would be equivalent to complex. I mean, both princes are complex things, contrary to some. Princes are complex things and frogs are complex things. And you cannot go from one to the other in one fell swoop. That violates some of the deepest principles we know or understand. And similarly, to worship intelligent aliens as gods would violate the same thing. Don't worship them. Respect them as products of probably a longer process of evolution than ours.
You just mentioned kind of the evolved godlike nature of these hypothetical aliens we're talking about. That sounds like something out of science fiction. In your press conference the other day that was closed, it was just, you know, for invited press, you seemed to suggest that you're, if not worried, at least you wonder if too much being steeped in fiction, fantastical fiction, say as a youngster, might lay a foundation for gullibility later in life. So if a youngster is into, well, you just mentioned the kind of fairy tale thing of a frog turning into a prince or spells or magic. Did I get that right about the other day? Is that your take?
I'm very hesitant about this. First, I should say that I love science fiction, where by good science fiction I mean fiction that is a fantasy, but which takes science seriously, and which perhaps changes one aspect of science in an interesting way to explore the possible consequences of this in fiction. And this might be a matter of changing one of the laws of physics, or it might be something less profound than that. It might be sticking with the existing laws of physics, but changing one thing like inventing a world in which we all live in a thick fog, so we can't see, and so we have to resort to some other kind of sensory system. That seems to me to be a very positive and good use of fiction.
But the stuff is—it's still plausible in that world. It's still kind of explainable.
That's
it's
right.
Not There's just magic.
It's not a totally undisciplined, profligate use of fantasy. The kind of fantasy that I'm not so keen on, or at least I'm dubious about, is the profligate kind, the kind where the hero simply has recourse to indefinitely powerful magic, can simply call up great powers without any disciplined explanation for how it came about. Spells.
Some of the greatest fantasy writers, they always make sure there's a cost to the magic, so it's not like some little rogue finds an amulet that gives him unlimited power, but no, he uses it and someone dies, or you cast a spell, but it only works once a year, or so there are these limitations. But I'm hearing out of you that you would almost privilege science fiction, coming from your vantage, and not say fantasy can be equally as enjoyable or fun. In other words, sword and sorcery type stuff, or my enjoyment of Dungeons and Dragons or comic books is somehow it could open the door to me being, it's like a gateway drug to religious belief.
Well, I have speculated about that. I do worry about it a bit. I'm thinking about it because I'm writing a children's book at the moment, and I, like most people, was brought up on fairy tales, Hans Andersen, Grimm, that kind of thing.
Did it make you more credulous as a kid?
I don't know. I mean, I think it probably did. And I think that, it's very easy to say, oh, children are not stupid. Children know that it's only fantasy. They know that it's only fiction. I think I probably was prepped for religion by being fed fiction, which led me to, it didn't exactly believe it, but somehow it seemed quite normal that if do you go back to the frogs and princes again, if frogs can turn into princes, then it's quite okay for water to turn into wine. And so when I was taught about biblical miracles, what might have been a natural skepticism wasn't there. Possibly because of a prepping, as I say, by fantasy fiction. Now, I don't want to say that I believe that, and I certainly don't want to say that I think children should be deprived of fantasy fiction.
Harry Potter doesn't necessarily merit a parental advisory warning.
No,
right?
That's right. I mean, I've never read Harry Potter, but I gather that's what it's about. But, I mean, I have two reasons for being very hesitant about this. One is I don't want to say that this happens. What I do want to suggest is that it might be a worthy subject for psychological research on children to actually try to investigate whether fantasy fiction for children does predispose them to believing in religious fantasy when the time comes. But my other reason for not wanting to come across too strongly here is that science depends partly upon skeptical reasoning, but perhaps even more importantly, science depends upon imagination, flights of imagination, thinking out of the box. And it's equally arguable that fantasy fiction in childhood could have a very good effect, as well as a possibly bad effect, could have a very good effect in leading children to value, to be good at thinking imaginatively about the non-mundane, to thinking about things that are part of the world of the imagination and not part of what we already know. Because science will not progress if we limit our theories, our models, to the things that we already know. Obviously it won't. We have to. The greatest scientists have allowed their imaginations to float free of the mundane. And there's a difficult balance to be struck between being imaginative in, I think it was Michael Shermer made the point earlier in the conference, making the contrast between Richard Feynman and somebody else, I can't remember who it was, where Feynman struck the right balance between between imagination and skepticism. Mm. And I think that, once again, it might be interesting to do research on the impact of fantasy fiction, fairy tales, magic fiction, on both the skeptical faculty, which we need in later life, and the imaginative faculty. And it could have a negative impact one way and a positive impact the other, and I would like to know.
I hear you saying, yes, skepticism, but not just critical thinking, also creative thinking, and I don't think anyone here would disagree with that. The research that you just maybe called for has not yet taken place, so just hazard a guess in your own personal life, maybe anecdotally, you mentioned that possibly your being steeped in fantasy fiction as a kid, you know, fairy tales, whatever, it made you believe in magical thinking in the real world. How did you end up to be Richard Dawkins if you had that liability early on?
Well, I can't really recall. I rather think that I did, at some age, believe in magic to the extent that I would, if I desperately wanted something to happen, I think I had been persuaded by somebody or something or some fiction or other, been persuaded that if only I wished for it long enough and hard enough, it would happen. I think if it didn't happen, I think I kidded myself into thinking it was because I wasn't wishing hard enough or something of that sort. I suppose I just grew up. I mean,
Richard, you've grown up, you've grew out of that. Does that mean that right now you can't enjoy fantasy, the fantastical, now that you've grown up? In other words, you've put away those childish things?
No. I enjoy fiction for a start, and you have to suspend disbelief to read any kind of fiction. I enjoy science fiction. I enjoy poetry. I enjoy all sorts of things which are, I don't want to come across as kind of grindian and lacking in imagination. I suppose what I'm trying to say is that the imagination, where it's disciplined, can lead us into pathways of wonder which are far greater than what I call profligate magic. That somehow the imagination that's achieved by the likes of Einstein and Planck and Heisenberg and Carl Sagan is far more wonderful, far more magical in the better sense of the word than a sort of Superman fiction where anything
hey
goes.
Now. I love my comic books, but yeah. Just on that point, I don't know why this is sticking in my craw, or maybe I do because I love those comic books, but I just want to share with you an anecdote about the oldest free thought organization in the United States. I've been a part of it, and there are representatives here in the audience. It's the Rationalist Society of St. Louis, founded in the 40s or something. Love that group. If I have the story right, they had a meeting a year or two ago, and I should interrupt myself to say that it's populated mostly by well-meaning, older, curmudgeonly sourpuss types. Go figure, go figure. And, you know, people get together and argue about yet another reason why God doesn't exist, and it's a fun time. It's a club for people like me. But a younger group, maybe a younger family, if I have the story right, showed up at one of their meetings, and there was a young boy, 11, 12 or something, had a copy of Harry Potter, you know, spells and magic, and he was scolded by one of the older guys, you know, why are you reading that? That stuff's nonsense. It's about spells and charms, as if reading that would make the kid not a good skeptic. I've bumped into friends. I've heard it a number of times. Oh, I don't read fiction. I only read nonfiction. And I get a whiff of that coming out of your argument, unless I'm misunderstanding where you're coming from.
No, I like reading fiction. I'm actually curious why. I mean, we all like reading fiction. I think I'm curious why. I mean, I think it's interesting in itself. Why we like fiction? Suspending disbelief is interesting. I suppose part of fiction is getting inside the head of another person. If the fiction is really well written, you are almost privileged to enjoy the sensation of being inside the consciousness of another person or several other people. I love fiction. I love science fiction. I wish I'd read Harry Potter so that I could respond in detail. I mean, one thing you said about Harry Potter, I think it was Harry Potter anyway, one thing you said earlier was that even what I call profligate magic is sometimes constrained by the magic amulet only works one day a year or something of that sort. I mean, that doesn't sound to me like a very interesting constraint. That seems to me. That
well,
sounds like a.
That was just my best guess. I mean, it gets better than that, I promise.
Yeah. Okay. In any case, as I was saying, I think it's quite possible that magic fiction does as much good on the imaginative side of science, what we need in science, as it even if it does harm on the other side, the balance may come out that it does more good than harm.
I'd like to end by talking about your new book. You mentioned it. Earlier, you were almost drawing distinctions between different kinds of magic. Yes, there's conjuring. There's this profligate magic, you know, belief in spells and fairies and changing one thing into another, and that could be harmful or it could engender kind of creative thinking. And we need research into that, I guess you're saying. But your new book is called The Magic of Reality. So it's not either of those kinds of magic. It's a different kind of magic.
Yes. I think I draw a distinction between three kinds of magic. There's the frog turning into a prince kind of magic, which doesn't happen. There's the magic as used by so many distinguished so-called magicians in this room, which I prefer to call conjuring, because we want to make a distinction between contrived, deliberate, skillful illusion, and I think Randy agrees with this. We want to make that distinction, and the sort of magic that doesn't happen. And the third kind of magic is the Carl Sagan magic, the magic of the universe, the magic of gazing up at the Milky Way, the magic of looking at images from the Hubble telescope. And it's that third kind of magic that belongs in the title of my book, The Magic of Reality.
And for the first time, is this your first children's book?
Yes, and I'm finding it quite difficult. The language that I use habitually is, I hope it's accessible, but I tend to assume that my reader is not allergic to dictionaries and doesn't mind that I could, if I think there's a lovely word that people ought to know, I don't mind using it. But you can't do that with a children's book, I think. At least to a limited extent, maybe you can. So I am finding it a bit difficult. The pattern of the book is that it's about science. The chapters pretty much stand on their own. There's not a narrative flow that goes from the beginning of the book till the end. So it's a series of questions. Each chapter is a question. What is the sun? What is an earthquake? Who was the first man? Why do we have day and night? Why do we have summer and winter? Questions like that, which any child might ask. Each chapter begins with a set of myths about the question, myths about the sun from all around the world, myths about earthquakes from all around the world. I don't neglect the Judeo-Christian myth, as in many cases, letting it be buried among the other myths and being given no privileged treatment. After the myths, then comes the science. What really is the sun? What really is an earthquake? Why really do we have winter and summer? day and night, etc. So that's the pattern of the book. It's fairly simple. My hope is that although the myths are colourful and appealing, the science will turn out to be even more colourful and even more appealing and even more magical.
And that's the magic of reality that you're certainly not worried about kind of inculcating in kids' superstition. With that, Richard, thank you for being so accessible this weekend. You've been busier than any other speaker on the program. We're very grateful. Thank you for your kindness to the JREF. Join me in thanking Richard Dawkins. Okay. Thanks for listening to this episode of For Good Reason. To get involved with an online conversation about today's show, join the discussion at forgoodreason.org. Views expressed on the show aren't necessarily the views of the JREF. Questions and comments about For Good Reason can be sent to info@forgoodreason.org. For Good Reason is produced by Thomas Donnelly and Brian Thompson and recorded from Los Angeles, California. For Good Reason's music is composed for us by Emmy Award-nominated Gary Stockdale. I'm your host, DJ Grothy.